Bankless Nation, we have a very simple question today. Is the Bitcoin ETF a big deal or not? That is the topic. That is the agenda in today's conversation. We are entering this episode and the price of Bitcoin is over 34K. So I think it just kissed 35K earlier today. David, are you feeling bullish, man?
I am feeling bullish. And after almost 2 years of just chewing glass in this market right now, I'm not prepared to be hurt anymore. And so if the Bitcoin spot ETF gets approved and it's not bullish, I need to know now.
To get that glass ready to put back in your mouth. Yeah. I think that's the question. And honestly, we have the perfect guest to help answer that question. We have Alex Thorne. He's the head of research at Galaxy Digital. He's published a ton of fantastic research about this. And we're counting on Alex today, David, to be objective about this, okay? He's not just going to tell us the bull case for the Bitcoin ETF, of which we know there is one. We definitely want to hear about that. Don't get me wrong, Alex. I know you're listening. We want to hear about the bull case. But we also want to hear the what if you're wrong case, right? The bear case for the Bitcoin ETF as well. And we got to find out, is this thing priced in? Is there a mountain of capital out there waiting to chomp on Bitcoin? That's the question in today's episode.
Certainly, certainly. We're going to get right to that question. But before we do, we need to hear from our friends and sponsors over at Doppel. So if you're like me and Ryan, and you have a bunch of Twitter followers and a bunch of doppelganger fake phishing accounts, then you should be interested in this. If you are a founder with a DeFi app that takes in deposits, you might also be interested in this. If you have impersonators who are trying to get in front of your customers' money and you, then you should get in touch with Doppel. Doppel is an anti-doppelganger service. So Doppel Bopper as a service. I'm making words up as I go.
Doppel Bopper.
Doppel Bopper. Yeah, so Doppel automates the detection and takedown of impersonators, malicious websites, phishing attempts, which are getting increasingly sophisticated. Bankless, we have impersonators. I know Blockworks just had a big impersonator. So if you plan on having a successful business, you probably are going to have someone who's trying to Doppel that, Doppel gang that. So Doppel wants to help you out. So they already serve brands like Meta, Coinbase, Solana, and Aave to help out pursue any phishing attempts, any malicious websites, cyber threats, etc. So there is a link in the show notes, doppel.com/sign-up.
Guys, this is the service that we use too. So we can testify. We use it's fantastic.
This. Yeah.
And there's a free trial going on right now. So click that link in the show notes. All right, David, one other question I think we have going into this episode with Alex is, I know we're going to talk about the Bitcoin ETF, and that's Bitcoin has certainly been on a run recently. But there's also like word of an Ethereum ETF as well. So if the ETF is bullish for Bitcoin, what about Ethereum? So I've not picked Alex's brain on this. I want to talk about that as well. Any other questions from you going to this episode that you want answered?
Yeah, I really just want to drill down on the, is this going to get approved or not? I think generally, we're making the assumption that this will be approved by January of next year, because that is when the earliest deadlines are up. The question is, what is the magnitude of capital that is waiting to purchase and why? And really, how does a spot Bitcoin ETF change the market structure of crypto at large fundamentally? And then how big is this before, after a moment? So these are kind of the high level questions that we're going to get into with Alex right after we talk to some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, especially Kraken, our preferred exchange for crypto in 2023. Don't buy the, if you're listening to Bankless, don't buy the spot Bitcoin ETF, just buy Bitcoin organically through Kraken. There's a link in the show notes to get started with Kraken today. Kraken knows crypto. Kraken's been in the crypto game for over a decade, and as one of the largest and most trusted exchanges in the industry, Kraken is on the journey with all of us to see what crypto can be. Human history is a story of progress. It's part of us, hardwired. We're designed to seek change everywhere, to improve, to strive. And if anything can be improved, why not finance? Crypto is a financial system designed with the modern world in mind. Instant, permissionless, and 24/7. It's not perfect, and nothing ever will be perfect. But crypto is a world-changing technology at a time when the world needs it the most. That's the Kraken mission, to accelerate the global adoption of cryptocurrency so that you and the rest of the world can achieve financial freedom and inclusion. Head on over to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures Inc. PVI, doing business as Kraken. Celo is the mobile-first, EVM-compatible, carbon-negative blockchain built for the real world.
world. And now, something big is happening. Introducing the Celo Layer 2. It's a game-changing proposal that's going to bring Celo's rapidly growing ecosystem home to Ethereum. Vitalik has shared his excitement for the Celo Layer 2 on the Celo forum, so has Ben Jones from Optimism. But why? The Celo Layer 2 will bring huge advantages, like a decentralized sequencer, off-chain data availability, and one-block finality. What does all that mean? Rock-solid security, a trustless bridge to Ethereum, and more real-world use cases for Ethereum without compromise. And real-world adoption is happening. Active addresses on Celo have grown over 500% in the last 6 months. With the Celo Layer 2, gas fees will stay low, and you can even pay for gas using ERC-20 tokens. But Celo is a community-governed protocol. This means that Celo needs you to weigh in and make your voice heard. Join the conversation in the Celo forum. Follow at Celo.org on Twitter and visit Celo.org to shape the future of Ethereum.
Arbitrum is accelerating the Web3 landscape with a suite of secure Ethereum scaling solutions. Hundreds of projects have already deployed on Arbitrum One, with flourishing DeFi and NFT ecosystems. Arbitrum Nova is quickly becoming a Web3 gaming hub, and social dApps like Reddit are also calling Arbitrum home. And now, Arbitrum Orbit allows you to use Arbitrum's secure scaling technology to build your own Layer 3, giving you access to interoperable, customizable permissions with dedicated throughput. Whether you are a developer, enterprise, or user, Arbitrum Orbit lets you take your project to new heights. All of these technologies leverage the security and decentralization of Ethereum and provide a builder experience that's intuitive, familiar, and fully EVM compatible. Faster transaction speeds and significantly lower gas fees. So visit arbitrum.io, where you can join the community, dive into the developer docs, bridge your assets, and start building your first app with Arbitrum. Experience Web3 development the way it was always meant to be. Secure, fast, cheap, and friction-free.
Bankless Nation, I would love to introduce you to Alex Thorne, the head of research at Galaxy Digital, leading a team of researchers focused on unpacking the market development in crypto and producing information for both internal and external audiences. And also before Galaxy, Alex was the director of blockchain research at Fidelity. So he's a veteran of straddling the trad world and crypto. Alex, welcome to the show.
Yeah, David, Ryan, great to be here and great to be with Bankless Nation. Thanks for having me.
So the big question on my mind, on Ryan's mind, on probably all of our listeners' minds is, what is the spot Bitcoin ETF going to do to the markets? We saw the false start, the fake start with the accidental slip of the Cointelegraph tongue not too long ago. But then all of a sudden, people have reconsidered as to what position, what side of the field that they want to be on. And people have considered themselves offsides. And that's where we've seen a lot of the price action in Bitcoin as of recently. But like I said, Alex, I'm not ready to be hurt again. And so if we don't get a bunch of buying pressure post spot Bitcoin ETF, I'd like to know it as sooner rather than later. So the question to you is, how much interest is in the spot Bitcoin ETF? And how do we even measure this? I'll throw those over to you.
Yeah, it's a good question. We tried to answer it. I will say we definitely don't know. We hear about a lot of interest. I think primarily the segment that we focus on are advisors in particular. So that, and those are an independent advisor, you know, Alex Thorne, like advisor with a storefront, but I don't have a back office. So I use Fidelity, Pershing, or Schwab, and others, these platforms. Those are independents. Or it's an advisor that's affiliated with a bank or broker dealer. So the big banks, most of them have a wealth management division, right? That's a big segment. When we add all of that up, that's about 47 trillion in AUM.
Wait, can I make sure I understand that, Alex? Yeah, 40, that's a big number. So you've got a chart here from your fantastic Twitter thread, and I think it has some of the numbers that you were just mentioning.
Yep. Okay, yeah, so this chart in the tweet is sort of the next step where we then discount that total AUM, but we're using as the top line number this 47 trillion, which is the total AUM of these three channels, broker dealers, banks, and RIAs.
Is it this? These are the three
48
channels,
trillion.
Right?
Yeah, 48 trillion.
Okay, okay. Can you break these channels down for us? I want to make sure the Bankless audience actually understands. So registered investment advisor, David and I call that's like the Edward Jones guy that, you know, was a coach on your stock team kind of person, right?
Yes, except Edward Jones is in the broker-dealer segment because they are a broker-dealer. So that a bunch of those big names are in that BD or bank segment. Whereas the RIAs, we call them RIAs here, all of these advisors at these platforms are registered investment advisors. But what we mean is more independent ones, literally like Alex Thorne advisor, right? Like by himself.
So can you break these down by line items? I'm actually just going to describe the table because some people will be listening to this on the podcast. They won't see the glorious visual that you could see on YouTube. If you go subscribe to the Bankless YouTube channel, everyone. But let me just describe this, and then you can kind of break down these categories and who they actually are, because it's very clear I don't understand who they are. But we've got a total of $48.3 trillion U.S. wealth management. Okay. And the breakdown, the categories that compose that 48.3 trillion, I said trillion with the T, is number one, broker dealer, 27 trillion. Number two, bank, 11.9 trillion. Number three, registered investment advisor, RIA, 9.3 trillion. Together, that equals 48 trillion assets under management. This is all U.S. wealth. That's like, actually, first, before we dive into those specific categories, U.S. wealth management, is this all our money? Is this all of the American people's money?
So this doesn't include self-directed accounts. So like if you have a Fidelity account with an IRA and that you manage yourself, that's not included here, right? If you have a brokerage account that you manage yourself, that's not included. This doesn't really include 401ks, which are not included, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or retirement accounts. This is really like when you pay someone to do investing on your behalf.
Okay. Okay. So this category
this is the amount of wealth that is under the discretion of somebody who's in charge of managing other people's wealth, who could potentially press the buy button on a spot Bitcoin ETF.
Yes, and it also doesn't include funds that you may buy, like a mutual fund, which is actually discretionary, right? Like the fund portfolio manager invests that money for the fund, but for you, if you just have it on like in an IRA that you manage yourself, then that would be non-discretionary. So yes, this is discretionary advising on behalf of other people.
Well, that's interesting because I do have a Fidelity account and I could purchase some spot Bitcoin ETF and that wouldn't be included here because that's self-directed.
No, and that's a major, I would say that's, I don't know if it's the biggest, we didn't look at that segment. And the reason is that we thought that the wealth management industry, these three segments you've described, Ryan, are the segment that will get the most net new accessibility to Bitcoin exposure from the ETF, right? Because you can already go buy Bitcoin on Kraken, right? You don't have to like buy it in the Fidelity account with the ETF. I mean, you could. I mean, you may, but it's you've been able to buy
it. I can and I do, Alex, except that I have these like legacy 401k accounts and legacy IRA accounts from like previous employers and other things I've set up that are managed in Fidelity, and I don't have a clean way to port them over to Kraken right now. So, but that is one category. Overall, you're right. Okay. So I interrupted you though. Could you describe these three categories? Broker dealer, bank, registered investment advisor. Who are these?
Yeah. So the broker dealers are SEC and FINRA registered broker dealers. That's a specific thing. They can buy and sell securities. They can do a variety of things, right? Offer securities, I believe BDs can do. Not an expert, to be clear, in the actual compliance difference necessarily between these, but those are the big firms you know about. Morgan Stanley, right? All of the big banks, most of the big banks are broker dealers and they fall in this category for us. Then you have maybe smaller banks. Think of like a regional bank, maybe can't offer their own securities, but they have wealth managers, right? They have a wealth management program. So your local bank, you can go in there and they've got, you know, some offices on one side of it that are people that will help you invest, right? And then like I said, the registers and investment advisors, there's even another category of those types of advisors that they're just not affiliated directly with the broker dealer or bank. They tend to use these more sort of white label-ish platforms. I don't remember all of the list of firms that offer them, but I know Fidelity does because I worked there, right? This is sort of a white label version of Fidelity.com, but it's meant for advisors so they can do sub accounts, manage multiple portfolios at the same time, right? It's sort of just white labeling the back office and UX infrastructure for advisors. And I think Pershing, Schwab, others offer that service as well. So that's basically what we're looking at, right? Because if you're an RIA that has an entire back office, like you're most likely a bank or a broker dealer anyway, right? So those are the categories that we looked at. And again, we wanted to be conservative. I absolutely think there will be retail demand for a Bitcoin ETF if it's you and your IRA, Ryan. Like you may want to buy it there, right? We felt that you could already buy it elsewhere, and so it trying to be conservative, we just focused on this channel that really doesn't have access at the moment. I can explain why they don't have access if that's interesting. Also,
do explain why. So, broker dealer, the bank, the registered investment advisor, why can't they log in Kraken and buy spot Bitcoin? Why can they buy MicroStrategy? Can they buy like GBDC, like the Grayscale Trust?
Yeah, they may be able to buy some of the like Bitcoin aligned equities, whether it's the one you mentioned or maybe mining stocks, right? I think that that is, they probably can buy straight equities, but those are pretty inefficient vehicles in the scheme of things for, I mean, right? They're not directly Bitcoin vehicles. There's other factors that go in there. The OTC products or the even the cash settled Bitcoin futures based ETFs that exist, those are not on the bank broker dealer platforms by and large. Those advisors that work for those banks and broker dealers that do client portfolio management and advising and investment management under the banner of those bigger firms, they can only put their clients into investment options that are approved by the bank and the broker dealer. And
wait, so they can't buy GBDC? They can't buy the Grayscale Trust right now? You're telling
no, me? Not really. With a specific exception, but they would have to go through typically an exception process. In fact, I'm not aware of any of those that actually allow their advisors to put end clients into the trust products or the cash settled ETF, future-based ETFs. Again, like I think, you know, if you brought like a client, if you were the advisor and you brought a client that was going to put a ton of money with you, if you let them do that, the bank or broker dealer might make an exception, but they're not offered on the menu.
They're just deemed too risky, too esoteric.
It could be a variety of things. Yeah. I mean, suitability in general could be a reason. I think I know of several, for example, of those bank broker dealers that don't allow cannabis ETFs or stocks, right? I don't know why. Do they not like cannabis? There could be a variety of reasons, right? So it could be that they're too costly, they're not suitable, they could be bad. I don't know, they just don't make it through a process, but those have a process. It is possible, I'm not sure, that the registered independent investment advisors that I talked about being on like the Fidelity platform or Pershing or Schwab or these other ones, they may have better access because those platforms, they're not actually like affiliated with the platform, right? They're just sort of buying it as a vendor. And so the platforms, I think, care much less about specifically what they're able to buy. But as you notice, and as you read, that is the smallest of the three segments we looked at. And we took that into account also when, you know, the tweet that you showed before, the first one, that's actually us then ramping up what we think the adoption will be per year. And you'll see that we have higher adoption levels in that independent segment than in the others, right? So, and that's for that reason, right? Like if you look in the first column, year one, we're basically handicapping the total AUM of each of these three segments by our estimate of how much total AUM will be able to access it, just purely be able to access it, right? So we're saying only a quarter of the AUM at the broker dealers, which is the biggest segment that we looked at, only a quarter will even have it turned on in the first year, right? So, and there's reasons behind, whereas we started with 50% for the RIAs, right? Because we think it's less of a lift. The platforms don't have to perform the same amount of diligence or care to perform typically the same amount because they're not a fiduciary behind those independents, right? Investments. They have to do stuff too, but we think they'll adopt it more quickly.
Proceeding in this conversation, yeah. I do kind of want to just like set the table about like what exactly the parameters of what we're talking about here. So we talked about these three different categories: the broker dealer, the bank, the registered investment advisors, 27, 12, and $9 trillion, respectively. This is what we are doing is we're talking about the mountain of capital that is out there that has never been able to buy Bitcoin ever before. And with this spot Bitcoin ETF, that pipe is now established between this $48 trillion and Bitcoin through the spot Bitcoin ETF. So like for all the podcast listeners out there, just imagine a pile of money that's $48 trillion large. And then look at the Bitcoin market cap, which is under $1 trillion. I think it's like $600 billion-ish, give or take. Right now. And so like these are two different sizes. Obviously, there's not going to be $48 trillion of buy pressure that there's no. Other very many other assets that is dedicated for. But that would be cool. Maybe one day. And so what you're doing in this next step, Alex, is you have then shaved that $48 trillion off into 25% for the broker dealers, 25% for the bank and 50% for the RIAs, because you're saying, well, of that $48 trillion, only a fraction will actually have access to that buy button. So we're going to trim off by, you know, 3/4 or a half for RIAs, right? Just because that is at day one, how much access there's going to be. So we're like reducing the pile of money that is actually able to potentially be interested in buying Bitcoin. And I think we're about to take this a few steps further about like, okay, well, still not 25% is going to buy, like actually a much smaller fraction.
Right.
But that's kind of where we are in this conversation. Where do we go next?
Yeah. So before we go to the next actual two steps, which are how much of those funds will choose to buy, and then how much will they buy? Those are the steps two and three. But if we instead look at year one, two, and three going sort of to the right in the chart, right, looking forward, and this is important because those two, steps two and three, we keep fixed through the entire time period of our analysis. So I'll talk about that in a second. But so what we're really doing is starting with the giant pile of money, the $48 trillion, and handicapping it based on segment. And when we look at, say, the banks and the broker-dealers, this is pretty straightforward. For each of them, we're saying 25% of the AUM will be addressable in year one, 50% of it will be addressable in year two, 75%. In year three, we're not just totally making it up. There's plenty of back of the napkin math here in general, right? This is more like a way to think about it. We think it's conservative, and we're using it to triangulate what the total addressable market is. But we did look at the specific broker dealers and banks. And like, for example, there are some we know of that already offer private Bitcoin investment vehicles on those platforms, right? So we assume, okay, they'll probably turn on the ETF in year one, right? They're not, and then there are others that we talked about that not only do they not offer an existing private Bitcoin vehicle, but they don't even offer other stuff that people consider risky the way they do crypto. And so, you know, maybe we put them in year two or three. So we tried to do it thoughtfully to the extent we know about the sentiment or public statements of the executives or the people, like whether they've said that they hate Bitcoin or whether they're open to it, right? That's how we come up with this ramping schedule, right? So the only thing in the analysis here that we actually change year over year is the big number, the total amount per segment that we think will have access, right? It's just that this first number we've been talking about, that's in our analysis, that's actually all that we change to ramp it up over time. Right. We say like the level of access at each segment is going to grow as they turn it on over.
Well,
over
because
time.
The big story here is, as David was saying, right, it's just like we're getting access to, we've gone from like 56K modem to high bandwidth access to capital for our Bitcoin product.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the reason, Ryan, you asked earlier why they couldn't buy on Kraken, right, the advisors, and I don't specifically know Kraken's products, but in general, the crypto exchanges, they haven't offered sub accounts in a way for, say, one advisor to log in and easily manage and control like all the various portfolios of their clients. And there's questions about custody. And by the way, also, even if they could, like some of these advisors may manage accounts for hundreds of people, and they use really slick UXs to do that and have back offices that know how to do it.
It's not integrated stocks, right? And bonds and ETFs.
And if you, let's say you're a wealthy investor that uses one of these advisors, like you could say like, okay, well, you know, why don't you write down that I'm going to buy like, you know, 500K of Bitcoin or something, and like include that in your analysis or whatever advisor. I'm going to go do it separately. And it's just like wealthy people don't want to do that. They want it all in the same place, right? And even if it were in the same place, even in spot, like there's trick, like if it was like everyone just had access to spot Bitcoin through these existing platforms, like then there's weird like custody things, the brilliance of the and transactional things, and like how do we use it, right? And who knows? And also then all these platforms that have to then build spot functionality, which is also, you know, hard, right? I mean, it's certainly not traditional. Whereas if it's wrapped in the ETF, like this thing just slides right in, like every other investment vehicle that is, you know, usable, goes into all the same portfolio management tools. It goes into all the, goes through the back offices exactly the same. Like it just looks like any other ETF.
Okay. So I think the big lesson that I'm learning here is that on the day that the spot Bitcoin ETF gets approved, everyone who's interested in buying Bitcoin through the ETF doesn't necessarily have access to it. There's like a rollout period. There's like an initiation.
And we just looked at year one, right? Like, I don't know that, and I'm actually quite sure that most of the banks and broker dealers will not turn this on day one. You might see the platforms that serve the independent RIAs turn it on faster, right? But I think, you know, that's why we say year one, and we could talk in a second if you want about like, okay, well then like when, right? How fast? Right. I and maybe like, you know, a lot of people are asking about like, what about day one? What if the day that they're announced that they're approved or the day that they launch, like what does it look like, right? Is it a buy the rumor, sell the news? Like what kind of, is it bullish that day and permanently bullish? Like, I don't know. But I just want to add the steps two and three to the analysis are pretty straightforward. So like if you say year one, right, we talked about 25, 25, 50 for those three segments, that comes out to 14.4 trillion, right? Which is, we just said that's about 30% of the total.
That's the total amount that would have access.
Yes. The total amount of existing capital too. The other thing we don't really estimate, like if totally new capital flows in, we're just sizing it based on the size of the wealth management market today.
Size the pipe.
Exactly. So then we say, okay, obviously if 14.4 trillion could invest, certainly they won't all invest, right? Mm-hmm. And here, I mean, this is a pretty back of the napkin thing. We said, you know, what's reasonable as a conservative number to say, choose to invest anything. We said 10%. Okay. So 1 in 10. I think
1 in 10
easily
just choose to invest.
Of any amount. It could be $1, it could be 100% of their portfolio, but only 10% of the total addressable capital market there does any investment, right? So now we're handicapping it again. And then we rely on this, like, well, how much do they invest? And we say, well, we just put out another paper about this a couple of weeks ago. Others have as well, but doing backtesting analysis on adding Bitcoin to a portfolio at various levels, drawing it from different parts of the existing portfolio, like drawing it from bonds or drawing it from equities or from alts and whatever, this whole thing at a whole bunch of different levels. And I mean, you know, obviously at a long enough time frame, it looks, for Bitcoin, for Ether, for a lot of these coins that have been around a long time, if you go back further, it just looks better and better. But we tried to be reasonable. We said 2018 to present, which was two bear markets and one bull market. So, and basically the biggest, it was positive across all allocation levels. So again, 10% we say here would choose to do something, and then how much on average they choose to do. We said 1%. And that's because it was good. I mean, it was at higher levels. Again, looking backwards, no guarantee that it would be the same going forwards. But at higher levels, it did better, even on a risk-adjusted basis, specifically on a risk-adjusted basis. But the biggest net positive impact was just going from 0 to 1. Like 0 to 2 was, 1 to 2 was good. But none of the steps had as big a change, which, you know, you've heard this, get off zero. I mean, that's the case for it. So that's how we picked that one number, right? 1% number. So it's year one, 25% of broker-dealers, 25% of banks, 50% of RIAs. That's 14.4 trillion that could have access, we think. 10% of that capital chooses to invest something. And on average, they do 1%. That's how we get the 14.4 billion in year one as
seems
inflows.
Conservative.
That's what we're trying to do, right? I mean, we're not trying to do too much moon math here. We really wanted to be like, this is a reasonable way to look at it. It's conservative. It's defensible. It, you know, who knows what could happen? There's certainly,
it protects David from getting hurt again.
That's true. We're not trying to increase expectations too much. Right. I mean, that is a solid amount of inflow, I would say, objectively. But yeah, I mean, I would, you know, some people really like this. A lot of people said it was too conservative. Some people said it was too bullish. I mean, right. I mean, when you put numbers out like this, it can go either way.
Right. Certainly. And well, there's one dynamic that I want to definitely parse out here, which is that on year one, you have modeled out potentially conservatively $14.4 billion of inflows into Bitcoin per year. So these are flows.
These are flows.
Not
it's
just
not
a
cumulative.
One-time buy moment. This is now you are saying there is going to be $14.4 billion of Bitcoin buy pressure per year. And actually that increases next year because of the increased access. So the next year that you have modeled out is $26.5 billion per year. So this is persistent yearly buy pressure into spot Bitcoin, correct?
That's the idea. Yep.
And just so I understand this too, to add to that, it's net new inflows.
Correct.
So these are inflows that we wouldn't have otherwise had, because we're going to have inflows flowing to Bitcoin. We already do have them, right? People are already buying their Bitcoin on Kraken to prepare for the next bull run. And hopefully you are, Bankless listener, doing some of this. But we're talking about absent an ETF, we wouldn't have had these flows on the bottom of your spreadsheet. Now that with an ETF, we will have added another $14.4 billion in year one, after the ETF is approved, of net new inflow of buying pressure to Bitcoin. Yes?
Yeah, that is our estimate, specifically, again, because we're focusing just on this big wealth channel, right? Because I would say, where would the overlap be? Like, what would reduce that for? Like, what if we were right on 14.4, but it actually wasn't all net new? That would mean that you were a client of an advisor, let's say, and you separately had exposure to one of the trust products in your own other brokerage account, or you had a bunch of spot Bitcoin that you actually chose to sell and then tell your advisor to go buy the ETF. And I don't think that's a terribly credible scenario, because there will be people, but not in the segment, I think, really, that we're talking about here. There might be people that own spot Bitcoin and would prefer to own the ETF in their brokerage account, right? Like, and so they actually sell it. But that's not really the advisor market. That's, I think, more like a retail brokerage type market.
One other thing I want to ask about this, Alex, is like, so I just want to test my intuition here, right? So this is imagining, this is kind of a spreadsheet view of the world, which is very helpful for analysts and researchers to kind of make sense of this and get to some actual tangible numbers. But this assumes all of the broker dealers and banks and RIAs and, you know, everybody advising this market, they're just dollar cost averaging in, you know, like I'm just going to put some money in and I do it every month and, you know, I'm doing my job. I'm dollar cost averaging in. That's not how investors work. We all know if the price is going up, they get super bullish about that particular product and they smash, they FOMO in, they smash the buy button. Don't tell me that broker dealers are any different than retail from that perspective. And so what we might find is, rather than this kind of like 14.4 billion and then 26.5 billion, it's like, if the price is going up, I would imagine some of this demand, well, the averages may be true, could look a little more choppy than in the spreadsheet. Would you say that's a correct intuition?
I think that's fair. I think I am going to say they are a little different than retail, and I'll tell you why, right? These advisors, they, first of all, when you use an advisor, typically they don't like day trade for you, right? They're not nearly as active as individuals might be that manage their own money and really succumb to that FOMO. I mean, I've used an advisor, like, I don't now, but years ago, during market volatility, and called up being like, what do you think about this? Should we do that? And usually the advisors, they've got a longer term plan for you, and they'll counsel against sort of rash moves.
That's what they're there for, to keep you rational.
It is. And to develop a long term portfolio, right? And I think when you think about sort of the long term thesis for Bitcoin, it really is a long term goal, even, right? The Bitcoin maximalist will tell you that also, for the most part, right? So like, I think that the advisor world is probably going to be less prone here to short-term market movements in general. So it's likelier to be stickier capital than, say, you know, people with a crypto exchange account or like in their own personal accounts. That's totally right. I mean, that's one of the many things that can happen that would change this analysis. I mean, dramatic moves in price in either direction, I think, would alter this.
Okay, so while we're talking on price, we've been talking about inflows, net new inflows, the entire conversation. So we have a year one of 14.4 billion in net new inflows, and that increases over time, 26.5 in year two and 38.6 in year three, okay? The question, though, is what impact does that have on the price of Bitcoin? Is there some sort of amplification effect? I think there's like a surface level analysis of somebody could hear this and say, oh, so you mean Bitcoin will go up $14.4 billion in year one? I'm not that excited about that, Alex. It's already $600 billion.
Right.
And you're just saying it's going to add 14.4 more? That's not quite how this works in the inflow world. Can you explain that to us? What's kind of the amplifier effect here?
Yeah, this is actually very hard to calculate like fully scientifically, because there's factors like liquidity and market depth that, first of all, are hard to actually wrap your head around now. Will be hard to understand and conceptualize a reasonable possible future under this market structure. And also you have to make assumptions about things like liquidity and depth and other things that are really tricky. Like, there's a lot of variables to really model that out from a bottoms up. So we did a similar analysis to this, or more of a top down thinking, right? And you can think about, like, Paul Tudor Jones had talked about, right? Gold's market cap is X, like Bitcoin's is Y, and like Bitcoin's only like 4%, and like, what if it went to like 10 or 20, right? Like, that was what he talked about in 2020. We did something a little similar, a little bit more intricate, but basically we looked at, we liked gold as a comp, and people debate this all the time.
Is this in your tweet thread, by the way, Alex?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this is where we look at the regression on price change based on the flows into the gold ETF. Some people were critical of our R squared here, but I think from looking at changes in price, 0.27 is pretty reasonable for drawing a correlation. We like the gold ETF for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, gold is you know, Bitcoin and gold are often compared. I've called gold, Bitcoin gold with wings. It's got similar scarcity properties, but you know, you can actually use it, right? Like you can't walk around with gold bars in your bag, and you can't really like, you certainly can't store large amounts in gold wealth really, unless you're like a sovereign or a central bank, right? I mean, it's like physically heavy, right? Like, but with crypto, including obviously Bitcoin, you can store huge amounts of wealth. In fact, the amount of wealth has no impact on the physical weight and all that stuff, right? So there's that overlap. But also, gold is a global scarce asset, commodity asset that didn't have big investment grade vehicles really until relatively recently, right? And that was an ETF and several ETFs.
2004, right?
Yeah. So I actually don't recall, but like, yeah, mid, I think it was around then, mid 2000s. Okay, so there's a comp, right? There's an inflows we can see, obviously different market at that time than today's market, like globally and whatnot. But, you know, it's close, right? And, so, and again, this is back of the napkin stuff. And we're trying, when you do this type of stuff, right? I also did venture at Fidelity at Avon Ventures. And, you know, when you come up with these types of TAM analyses, you're really just trying to triangulate on something that's reasonable, a reasonable way to think about it. You know, you're always welcoming to others to challenge these assumptions, right? You just have to make some if you're going to do the exercise, right? So we looked at like what percentage of Bitcoin today is in investment vehicles and what percentage of gold today is in investment vehicles. And then, you know, we think gold, and then we looked at market cap comparison. You know, gold's about 24 times larger in total market cap, but has 36% less supply in investment vehicles, right, is what we were pointing out. So that gives us a dollar equivalent amount of fund inflows to Bitcoin, having an 8.8 times greater impact on Bitcoin markets compared to gold markets, right? So this is the kind of, you know, we set it up a pretty clear methodology. I don't know if it almost certainly isn't the correct methodology. There really isn't a correct one. And then we basically model forward using our inflows, and looking at the comparison and the, using that as a multiplier, we look at the historical relationship, which is this regression chart between inflows into the gold ETF and what it did to like XAU USD gold spot, right?
And okay, then this 8.8 number, I really want to drill down on, because if my memory serves me correctly, as soon as the gold ETF got approved and was made available, the gold had just an insane bull run over the next decade, I think.
Yeah.
It's like a sustained, a very impressive bull run. And you're saying this number that you're coming to is that the equivalent of dollar amount invested into Bitcoin is going to have an 8x8 greater effect on the Bitcoin price than what would have been into the gold price, correct?
Yeah, that's our view. And
just to be clear, that's extremely bullish, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's the back of the napkin math. I mean, I think there are some, by the way, there's some huge, reasonable disagreements on this. For one, when gold ran in the mid 2000s to, you know, through the great financial crisis, that was a massive macroeconomic event that impacted gold's price as well, right? It wasn't just accessibility. And it did also take a while for inflows to really start ramping into those vehicles. So it wasn't immediate. And there's almost certainly were other factors at play causing people to invest in gold than simply not having been able to. But that's the basic. And then basically hold that constant. We hold that inflow constant, and then we reduce the multiplier each over each month forward that we look at, because as Bitcoin grows, then it becomes its percentage in vehicles to its total market cap like grows, right? So the multiplier actually declines in our analysis, but it start right, and so it decays as Bitcoin grows. Again, can't stress it enough, right? But this is what we think is a defensible way to think about it. It's not certainly no guarantee, but that I think we came to about a 75%. If you agree with our other inflows analysis, about a 75% price appreciation from launch to 1 year forward.
Yeah. And I think the disclaimer here is like, we're stacking assumptions on assumptions. And so at the end of the day, like the rope gets frayed, but still directionally, we can start to model out some sort of prediction about some ultimate actual price impact. And Alex, I want to actually see if I can get a number out of you, as well as a few other questions as well. Just like, where is Bitcoin price going? Maybe as to the nearest of our ability to predict it. But also there's like a bunch of ancillary things as well, like the market timing for when this is getting approved. approved is interesting. Like, we're closer to a bear market than when spot Bitcoin futures got approved, which was at the top of the bull market in 2017. Liquidity is low. Also, there are some other like side effects. Like, well, now there's Bitcoin ETF marketing from some of these big issuers. And so how does that play into public sentiment? So I'm going to ask you all these questions. But first, a moment to talk about these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible.
MetaMask Portfolio is your one-stop shop to navigate the world of DeFi. And now, bridging seamlessly across networks doesn't have to be so daunting anymore. With competitive rates and convenient routes, MetaMask Portfolio's bridge feature lets you easily move your tokens from chain to chain using popular Layer 1 and Layer 2 networks. And all you have to do is select the network you want to bridge from and where you want your tokens to go. From there, MetaMask vets and curates the different bridging platforms to find the most decentralized, accessible, and reliable bridges for you. To tap into the hottest opportunities in crypto, you need to be able to plug into a variety of networks, and nobody makes that easier than MetaMask Portfolio. Instead of searching endlessly through the world of bridge options, click the bridge button on your MetaMask extension or head over to metamask.io/portfolio to get started. You know Uniswap. It's the world's largest decentralized exchange with over $1.4 trillion in trading volume. You know this because we talk about it endlessly on Bankless. It's Uniswap, but Uniswap is becoming so much more. Uniswap Labs just released the Uniswap mobile wallet for iOS, the newest, easiest way to trade tokens on the go. With the Uniswap wallet, you can easily create or import a new wallet, buy crypto on any available exchange with your debit card with extremely low fiat on-ramp fees, and you can seamlessly swap on Mainnet, Polygon, Arbitrum, and Optimism. On the Uniswap mobile wallet, you can store and display your beautiful NFTs, and you can also explore Web3 with the in-app search features, market leaderboards, and price charts, or use Wallet Connect to connect to any Web3 application. So you can now go directly to DeFi with the Uniswap mobile wallet. Safe, simple custody from the most trusted team in DeFi. Download the Uniswap wallet today on iOS. There is a link in the show notes.
Are you launching a token? Is it already live? How are you managing the legal and tax for providing token awards for your team? Toku simplifies everything about managing token grant compensation, and you can get started with them for free. You'll have access to top-notch legal and tax support to handle the distribution and management of tokens for your team. Toku caters to every step in the process, from user-friendly legal templates for granting tokens to tracking vesting periods and calculating withholding taxes. Toku understands every grant structure, token purchase agreement, restricted token awards, restricted token units, token options, and all the other ones. Toku is already simplifying this today for leading companies like Protocol Labs, DYDX Foundation, Mina Foundation, and many more. You can learn more about how Toku can help you streamline your token management and get started for free. Visit Toku at toku.com/bankless or click the link in the description below.
Bankless Nation, we are back with Alex Thorne. We are zoning in on the questions. So we got all these new inflows, suspected inflows coming in from the Bitcoin ETF launch. What's that going to do to Bitcoin price? And I think we were getting there. And you may have mentioned it as a side point, a number 74%. I want to zone in on that. So what does this mean, Alex? And how much will these inflows actually impact Bitcoin price according to your analysis? So I've got a tweet thread up here that ends with ETF. First year Bitcoin price impact estimated 74.1%. What do we mean? What do we mean? Are we taking the price of Bitcoin as of now and we're multiplying that by 74%, or like, and then we're adding that to the price? Like, what are we doing with the 74% number?
Yeah. So this is just from like launch day one is the idea, ETF launch. So I think we calculated it in the report as the bottom of this tweet says that at the end, we just used end of month, September, because we wrote this in mid October. You would basically take this ramp and do it from whatever price Bitcoin is at the start, right? So, because this is really focused on inflows driving that appreciation. So,
Bitcoin price, let's say the ETF launches in January 2024, okay, and that's like maybe an estimate from most of the analysts we talked to around that time range. And let's say the price of Bitcoin is 50K at that time, right? Then we apply this analysis on top of the 50K Bitcoin, yes?
That's the idea. But you know, I think it's pretty reasonable to think, and I think David might have mentioned this at the beginning too, like how much of it is priced in already, right? I mean, I think if we run that far, like you'd assume a fair amount of the price is priced in. But again, our inflows analysis does not suggest that like there's a priced in amount. So yes, in this analysis, you would add 75% on top of that.
To me, the price inflows sounds pretty price insensitive, as in they don't really care what the price of Bitcoin is. They kind of just are the DCAers. They're just the smash buyers. I don't really care what the price is.
That's the idea, right? Like we're just saying one in 10 of capital that could access it would choose to. I think that's a pretty low number, right? We're not saying right. 1 in 5. We're not. Now, could that be lower? Yeah, it could be 1 in 20, right? That would be 0.5%, not 1%. That cuts the whole thing in half, right? It's totally possible. We don't know. But sorry, it could be 5%, not 10%. They could choose to allocate less. But excuse me, the portfolio benefits for the 1% allocation, when we came up with that, and we're certainly not unique in suggesting that. I've heard that from plenty of people over the years with different analyses. That encompassed bear markets and bull markets. So that included when price was very high, right? It still was additive to the portfolio over that 5-year time frame. So yes, this analysis does not actually like calculate what would happen if the price ran up really high or really low. That's
well,
just
because you guys can't calculate that, or else you're a market oracle and you know the future, and you're you know, you've time traveled like Marty McFly, right?
Exactly.
So, okay, right. So I just want to understand that. So per my example, if in January the Bitcoin ETF is launched and it's at 50K, over the inflows over the next year, we would expect Bitcoin to increase another 74%. That's another 37K, and we get to a price at the end of 2024, all else being equal, of 87K or something like that. That's what this analysis would predict. That's what the math predicts.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yes, that's what it says. And I know we've said it a million times, right? Just back of the napkin, not a total prediction here. But yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. And then is there any way to anticipate like the front running then piece of that? Let's just isolate that for a second. So, you know, Bankless is the number one podcast in crypto. Okay. So this is getting out there everywhere right now. And so a bunch of people are looking at these numbers from Alex Thorne, and they're saying, huh, okay. You know, your price could increase by 74%. So I better buy now. And that induces more demand, I suppose. And I don't know. There's some front running.
It borrows demand from the future.
Yeah. So can the front running, how much will the front running dampen this demand? Are you just setting that aside for this analysis? Is there any way to tell?
Yeah, there isn't really. I would say there isn't really in this analysis, right? I agree. It's actually really hard to think about, because I can see reasons why it could both induce more demand or dampen it. So dampening is pretty straightforward. You look at it when you get access and you say, gosh, it's gotten pretty expensive. Like, maybe we should wait for it to come down more. You know, we liked it at 30, but at, you know, 50, that seems expensive, right? So that's the obvious thing. People might choose not to allocate if that were to happen, or not allocate yet. But again, we're looking at a whole year here, right? Like, we didn't say like month one, two, because we know there's a lot of variables. The other side of it is we've seen Bitcoin volatility come down over the years, like on a realized basis. You can see that chart's lower highs, and when it gets low, it never really goes lower than the lowest it's been. It was actually like super low, like last year was super low, earlier this year at some points in like the low 20s, which is very low for Bitcoin historically. But with declining volatility and increasing market cap and liquidity, you can actually allocate more, right? That's why we're risk adjust. That 1% analysis on allocation size is based on using Sharpe ratios and risk adjusting it for volatility. Right. So if it got bigger and volatility is lower, then you can allocate more, right? Because on a risk adjusted basis, there's less risk in terms of volatility. So in that sense, you could see that there are people that there might even be others that we don't even really talk about, or just really, really big clients of bank, broker, dealer, independent RIA platforms that have so much money that 1% like is a ton of money, right? Or they want to put some to it and they simply can't because of volatility and other things. So you could see that if it's bigger, let's get really big. Let's say sovereign wealth funds or central banks themselves, right? It's just too small for them. I mean, even at a trillion, it's probably too small. Trillion market cap, right? So there are pools of capital that won't come in until volatility is much lower and liquidity is much higher. So you could, you know, so there is an induced demand factor too. But again, like this is, you know, we really just can't know. I think our analysis is based solely on the fact that we hear there's demand. We know there's a giant pile of wealth that can't access it. And the accessibility is what will, you know, again, 1 in 10 people owning some Bitcoin. I think that's below even the White House's estimates for people that own crypto. So I think it's conservative that the same numbers would carry forth into these new addressable markets.
I think understanding that if the Bitcoin price appreciated significantly up to the event of the spot Bitcoin ETF approval and made accessible to all this capital, like rationally, it would make sense that there would be less demand for it because price went up. Like if the thing is higher, therefore there's less demand for it.
Yeah.
But also I've done a few cycles of crypto. That's not how things work. Like when Bitcoin price goes up, people want more of it. And I think there's definitely an argument to be made that like the marketing, what is Bitcoin's marketing department? It's price. And so if the price does lead into the approval, which leads into further continuation, followed by BlackRock legitimately marketing Bitcoin to its customers, because there's a big race. There's like how many horses in this race trying to become the number one Bitcoin spot ETF?
And so this is going to, right now. Yeah.
Right. So there's 11 or 12 like organizations, big capitalized organizations, all going to be marketing to try and jostle their ETF into position to be number one. So there's going to be a massive marketing campaign, right? Am I assuming too much here? Or like this is kind of like the more like I've seen a cycle or two of how this plays out. This seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know exactly what all the applicants are planning. But if you look at past like ETF launches or when REITs became popular, like you see a fair amount of marketing, right? And there's also educational materials created for all the potential buyers, right? So like,
bullish.
That's going to happen. There's clearly a competition afoot. So
it's fascinating to me how much Larry Fink is talking about this. He's of course is the CEO of BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world right now by a long shot. And he has become like almost Michael Saylor, like in his
as soon as they have a product to sell, they're bullish on Bitcoin.
I was surprised how far he went. You know, you're probably referring to Ryan, the clip from maybe now 2 weeks ago or so when he said that like in an upheaval world or macroeconomic uncertainty,
flight to safety.
Yeah, gold, Bitcoin, gold dollars, and Bitcoin could be a flight, part of a flight to quality trade. I agree with in the scheme of things. I know that historically people trade Bitcoin and crypto more as a risk asset, but I think it's fair to look at Bitcoin and say that it's fundamentally quite predictable, transparent, it's global, right? Like there are things that should make it like a safe haven asset in terms of its fundamentals. But yeah, to hear Larry Fink say that I think was pretty surprising and I will say monumental.
Okay. Are you guys ready to burst some bubbles here now?
No.
No, sorry, David. We're doing it anyway. David, put your mic down for a minute here. Okay. So the bull is going on mute. So, Alex, give us the bear case for all of this because I know you've heard it. We've laid out the bull case quite well, and we've brought the numbers and the analysis kind of backing the bull case, and it's based on inflows to, higher bandwidth pipe to a lot of capital. We get all that. What's the bear case for all of this? I've heard some people say that. Like this is overhyped. It's already priced in. It's already, front run. Look at the recent ETH futures ETF. It's kind of just like done nothing with respect to numbers. Everyone who wanted Bitcoin already had access to it. Basically, the Bitcoin ETF is overhyped. Ain't nothing going to happen with respect to price. Just kind of like the sound of a balloon deflating. So give us the rationale behind that bear case.
There's a couple. I'll start with some of the ones you specifically mentioned, Ryan. I mean, everyone can already access Bitcoin, right? It's something I hear a lot. And we've talked about this, how you and I can go buy it on exchanges, on Coinbase or Kraken or River or Cash App. We can, right? But I've talked a lot about already why like wealth channels can't, right? They don't have access to those platforms. They don't have the cash settled futures ETFs. They don't have the OTC products, typically the OTC trusts. That's why we only looked at this group, right? I mean, I think that's the first thing I would sort of say is on accessibility. Sure. Like I said, if I have a wealth advisor and they have, 99% of my family's money or whatever, my money, I'm free to take 1% of it and go open an account at Kraken. Like, sure I am. Right. But most don't, I would say that use, and certainly the advisors themselves don't bring it there on your behalf. So I think the accessibility question, this is why we focused on this channel specifically, but it's absolutely possible. I don't really think of there won't be as big inflows as people think as an actual case. I think the real thing is what could cause there to not be big inflows. And I think there are a couple things. One, the biggest thing is a significant risk off move in markets, right? Like we talked about, how I think and how Larry Fink said that Bitcoin could be part of a flight to quality trade. Well, it mostly hasn't been historically, like, and maybe it isn't. And then there is a need to fly to quality and people instead go to something else.
It's been more of a risk on type asset.
Absolutely. Right. And we could have, you could have a recession come or something like that, a big financial problem that's, you know, on the back of the rates and the inflation questions, like that could all move risk in ways that, you know, could dramatically affect people's appetite for something like Bitcoin, period. Right. Like, so a material change in that environment, which is possible, that could be caused by geopolitical events. It could be caused by a financial crisis. Who knows what, right? Let's say inflation ramps up again huge, right? Just like in the 70s and 80s, when Paul Volcker was in charge of the Fed, they tried to come down from their first hikes, then they couldn't, and they had to ramp hikes way back higher, right? That could dramatically affect risk appetite just generally, right? Which would certainly, I think, affect a Bitcoin ETF. So that's a main one, right? I was like, in terms of like the anticipation versus the inflows, like I you know, if I had to guess, like there are plenty of people now trying to, you've seen it in Bitcoin price over the last month, right? Like there are people trying to price, like reprice the asset given the likelihood or not likelihood in their minds of the ETF, of ETFs generally. So it absolutely could be like a buy the rumor, sell the news event on the announcement or the launch, right? Because these things also take, even if you're bullish, like they could take a while to ramp up. Like I said, even the most bullish platforms might not turn it on for, it could be months, right? It takes, and now it's got to go through their whatever like risk approval process and committees they have. So like our accessibility argument could take longer than we thought, right? Even if we're right on the actual demand, like the turn on, the ramp up time could be slower than we thought. There's plenty of that is possible, right? We don't know how fast, like I said, the broker dealer advisor segments would turn this on. Like, that's why we tried to be conservative and said only a quarter of them would even get it turned on in the first year, right? That's a major thing that could affect it. And who knows, right? I mean, there could be regulatory issues that also affect it. I don't think Bitcoin within the crypto ecosystem is that much in regulators' focuses, but of course, anything like, there's certainly stuff in particular that could happen, like on mining, for example. One of the things you've seen all the applicants update their S1s with is additional risk disclosures around mining, specifically around that the, you know, electricity usage of mining could cause political backlash, which could result in regulation. So like that's something that could happen. I don't think that's very likely, but that could happen. But also there's other regulatory stuff that touches all of crypto, right? Like we were talking about like FinCEN related stuff that could impact all the exchanges, or, you know, we saw Senator Warren was effectively saying that self-custody was, you know, the chosen tool technology of terrorists. Self-custody is important to Bitcoin also, right? Like that would be negative for Bitcoin, just like it is for any other crypto in general, I think. And some people say, well, the ETF's not going to be self-custodied, so couldn't that even like be good for it? And I'm like, no, it's just bad for the overall case for crypto in general. If something like, if a ban on self-custody were to happen, you know, what Bitcoiners talk about is executive order 6102, the seizure of gold by the US government, right? Like that would be bad overall. So there's regulatory stuff like that that could impact demand for Bitcoin ETF. I still think, like, even if it's a buy the rumor, sell the news on the event, either the announcement of approvals or the launch or whatever you want to talk about, whatever the event driven cycle is there, like that we're talking in this report and also thinking about it as more of a long term thing. We know it's going to take a little while to happen. We know the inflows don't happen overnight, right? And I also think you mentioned the ETH futures ETF. I mean, very different market, but we also know these products aren't really like that great, like certainly not for long term. The longer you hold, the more decay and roll cost you incur. And if you look at, and it's not like terrible, those vehicles are pretty good for short term exposure in the scheme of things. They perform pretty close to NAT, to like spot price in the shorter terms, but advisors are more longer term investors, right? So that's another reason why they don't particularly like those products. So I don't know.
I think, Alex, a lot of the things you're pointing to are just general, like, you know, bearish crypto, right? bearish
nothing to do with
Bitcoin
this
type takes, right? It's like
I'm still bullish.
I think even the biggest, baddest bear would have to admit that all else being equal, they could still think that your Bitcoin price is maybe front running this, that it's overhyped, that it's all priced in. But they'd have to admit that expanding the pipe of Bitcoin inflows to the tens of trillions of dollars that are available, that's like, worst case, that's neutral for Bitcoin. It's not negative for Bitcoin. It's not going to mean price go down. It can't be bad, right?
Right.
And think of the history, the trajectory of this asset. We are 15 years, about 15 years from launch. We just celebrated the birthday of the Bitcoin white paper yesterday. And we are 15 years and we've gotten magic internet money worth nothing, zero, okay, to 600 billion being shilled by the biggest asset manager in the world in 15 years. That is quite the accomplishment, I would say. So hard in that context not to interpret this as bullish either.
I agree. And you have to realize too how powerful just the ETF wrapper as a product is, right? I mean, it has overhauled the asset management industry. It makes trading, you can have passive ETFs that track, you know, one commodity, like you talked about gold. You can have them that track a basket passively, like, you know,
it's like a TradFi's ERC-20, right?
It's a wrapped asset basically, right? But then you can use them in all the infrastructure like they're a standalone equity. So you can do things like depending on who you are, you can do margin lending on them, right? Securities lending. You can send and settle them like they're like intraday all day. Unlike a mutual fund, they can have their shares created and redeemed all day. Whereas if you invest in a mutual fund, you have to send a check or, you know, a wire or whatever in. And it doesn't get added until after the close, and then you can't take it out until after the next close, right? Like, they're great products in general. They make investing highly accessible. And I would say, I mean, gold being one of the most iconic examples, like, there was really no investment grade gold access, period. Like, you could, if you were wealthy enough or whatever, you could call up some of the big banks or broker dealers, have like a metals desk, and they would like buy spot gold for you and keep it in a vault somewhere for you, right? But like, you're not like moving it around, you can't get in and out of it quickly, right? So I agree. I also, the marketing is a huge point, right? Like, it matters that, and also if it were to be approved, if they are to be approved, that's a pretty big stamp of approval, right? I mean, especially if you're sort of not in the day-to-day of this and you're saying, wait, the SEC has just approved Bitcoin spot ETFs. Like, if that happens, it talks about the level of maturity of the industry, the questions around things like custody and transferring and even like illicit finance have been sufficiently answered, right, for the approval to have happened. So there's a lot that legitimizes it. By definition, it institutionalizes it. And, you know, when the largest asset manager, keep in mind, I think Fidelity is the third largest asset manager in the world, and they're also deeply involved in Bitcoin and have been for years. So like, it's starting to look like all the smartest people that, you know, asset managers think this is a really good product at this point and should be approved. You know, it's not little, the maturity of the applicants is also a big part of the stories we've talked about with Larry Fink and others. So
this is a little bit of a side quest, but I was reading this article about conservative response towards legalized marijuana. And as soon as marijuana was legalized, conservative marijuana consumption just like approached baseline, where it used to be like so anti-marijuana. Really? And then as soon as it was legalized, like, yeah, they were just like eating the consumables. Okay, yeah, it's okay now. Yeah. Right.
Some people are saying, yeah, I guess some people's reason was just, we don't want to do things that are illegal, basically. Right. And if they're 100%. Legal, then we'll consider it. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. And I mean, obviously this is just like, Bitcoin's not illegal, but you know, if this kind of rhymes, right? Just like, as soon as it's gotten the regulatory stamp of approval, people are like, I'll buy it.
Now we can consider it, right? I mean, that's the other thing we talk about with the advice, because even if you could access the trusts or the cash settled futures, there's like suitability reasons why you wouldn't look at it, right? Like, if you'd say, these fees are too high, you might say, I know the trusts have pretty high fees, like that might just be a reason not even to bother learning about Bitcoin yet. So the only vehicle I can buy is fees that are way beyond what I would ever allow my client to pay, right? You might say. So you don't even consider it, right? Same thing if they're not on the platform at all. The second it's on the platform, like, you've got
to... You need an excuse not to.
Yeah, the question starts being like, well, like, let's say Bitcoin, you don't invest and your advisor misses like a big run in Bitcoin, and they could have done it, and they really could have, because custody is taken care of, all the KYC stuff, all the compliance, it's all taken care of by the issuers, right? And these are real issuers. Have you done your job at that point? You really have
to
consider.
Let's remember what we're talking about, this capital. We're talking 1 in 10 choose to invest in Bitcoin at all. And then that investment of those 1 in 10, only 1%. That's what your analysis is. It's really a tiny fraction, right?
Right.
Okay. So as we end this episode, Alex, I want to tee up the question. Let's take off our Bitcoin hat for a minute. Actually, no, I'm going to keep my Bitcoin hat on, my Bitcoin bull hat on, and I'm going to put over top of that hat an Ethereum bull hat, okay? So the arguments that we just made for Bitcoin, do they also apply for the possibility of an Ethereum ETF, which, according to some analysts, James Seffert and others, if you get the Bitcoin spot ETF approved, then we might be, this is lower probability than Bitcoin ETF, but we might be months away. I don't know, months, could be 6 months, could be 3 months, could be 12 months from an Ethereum ETF. And if that is the case, don't all of the arguments that we made for Bitcoin then also apply for Ethereum, and maybe in an amplified way, because Ethereum is lower market cap. Ethereum has even less legitimacy than Bitcoin in kind of like TradFi, right? Gary Gensler's constantly like, well, I'm not going to tell you if it's a security or not, you know? So what is your take on the potential of an Ethereum ETF to affect Ether price?
So our analysis isn't, I wouldn't say the price in particular isn't directly comparable, because I'm not sure that we would comp it to gold in the same way, which is what we did for Bitcoin. But I would say in terms of accessibility, it all absolutely applies, right? I mean, there are not, just like there are not, advisors are not able to access, you know, Bitcoin, they're not able to access these Bitcoin products today, the existing ones, the cash out futures, the trust or whatever, or like Kraken spot, like they're not able to access ETH spot really, or the ETH trust or the, so I think from an accessibility standpoint, it absolutely will have a pretty large market. I think the narrative for the investment community is further behind. I also think it's thought of more as a risk asset or a technology investment than Bitcoin, which people are, you know, the Bitcoin is digital gold mantra, I think, is really taken hold in a lot of investors' eyes and minds. So I'm not sure what I think it's, we have to think about it a little bit differently. By the way, we will think about it. We will rerun an analysis like this on ETH for the same sizing the ETH ETF market, we'll, you know, call at some point. I think the accessibility, which as we described, right, in our analysis, that's the main thing we're altering, right? I mean, we stayed flat at 10%, choose to invest 1%. I don't know if we'll come to the same exact flat, like unchanging variables, but the ramp could look very similar in terms of the total addressable market. I really respect Eric Balchunas and James Seyfert at Bloomberg Intelligence. They've been really great on the legal and regulatory approval process, timing and all that for the Bitcoin ETF, right? The reason they're saying this is because one of the core argument that the DC Circuit Court of Appeals made in that Grayscale ruling was that there's no material difference between the futures ETFs and the spot ETFs. In fact, I think they said there was mathematically no difference, right? They used the term mathematically. Well, I mean, then the argument obviously holds. Well, like, I mean, if the SEC approved the Bitcoin futures ETFs and now they're, you know, doing work on the spot ETFs, and if they do approve the spot ETFs, well, don't we also have ETH futures ETFs? Wouldn't the same argument apply? I think like I see the logic in why, you know, they could be forthcoming after. We haven't done the math on it. I don't know exactly where we'd land. I do think of Ethereum generally as more of a technology innovation play than a pure digital commodity. Of course, they're both like gas tokens for their networks. There are things that are very similar, right? They have similarly, not that inflationary. They're both quite scarce in the scheme of things. Like, so I can do the EI 1559 conversation versus like Bitcoin predictable scarcity, but like, right, there are overlaps. But I think it's a little different, but that could also even be extremely positive. Like, I think it, they would be big. I think they could definitely be big. There are a lot of people that own Ethereum and a lot of other people who might want to own it that can't currently.
Well, Bankless Nation, you heard it here. There still might be some opportunity to front run Bitcoin. It depends on how you think this is all going to shake out. And it certainly seems like there's some opportunity to front run Ethereum. I will say one thing, Alex, is we recently had some of the folks over at Fidelity on for an Ethereum episode. And it was really interesting, the kind of the more recent narrative around Ether, particularly being staked as kind of like an internet bond type of narrative. So this idea seems to be in the early stages of taking hold in TradFi, which is very exciting for Bankless because we've been talking about this for a long time, which is if Bitcoin is gold, then Ethereum could be this form of internet bond, which could really be interesting, particularly if you had a staked Ether ETF at some point in time.
You have to assume that the ETFs, if they come out for Ether, will stake a large portion. I mean, I think most of the custodians will too. Yeah. So I think it's an interesting differentiator, absolutely, from an asset standpoint, right? I mean, it generates some kind of return, even if it's dilution protection or a yield or whatever you want to call it. Like staking adds an interesting component here.
Alex, this has been incredibly helful, and you are doing this from a fantastic podcasting booth, podcast studio, I believe, at the offices where you reside at Galaxy, and that is also because you have your own podcast, as I understand it. What do you guys do on the podcast? What's coming out next?
I appreciate that, Ryan, a lot. Our podcast is called Galaxy Brains. It's typically we talk with one of our head traders, Bimnet Abibi, about market conditions and macro for the first 10 minutes. And then we have a guest from somewhere in the ecosystem, occasionally somewhere from Galaxy. This week, we have two of the top Senate aides that worked on the Bipartisan Proof Act, which has been introduced in Congress, which bans the commingling of customer funds at crypto exchanges and custodians, and also requires a cryptographic proof of reserves attestation on a monthly basis. Very interesting narrow bill.
Bankless,
on the
this is something we like. We like the Proof Act, right? Like Alex, like this is a
this
good
is
thing.
Pretty this... narrow and straightforward, right? If you hold my funds, then you got to keep them out of your account, and you also have to cryptographically provide some attestation that, and then an auditor will compare that to what they said you're supposed to have, and then that has to be published. The bill doesn't actually say how much that it has to be one-to-one. We're saying you have to publish it. So we'll be able to know if, you know, you claim that you have 100%, but you don't actually. That's the idea.
Give us some SBF protection going into the next bull run. So where can folks access that episode, Alex?
Yeah, galaxybrains.io takes you right there. But you can also see all of the stuff, including our reports that we talked about today at galaxy.com/research.
Bankless Nation, we will include some links in the show notes for those resources that Alex just mentioned. Alex, thank you so much for coming on Bankless. We're very excited about the bull case for Bitcoin and months away, January?
Close. Okay. We don't know, but I agree with that. January 10th or sooner is the most likely, in my opinion.
All right. January 10th or sooner. It could be a fantastic new year. Alex, thank you so much for coming on Bankless today.
Yeah, Ryan, David, thanks for having me.
Cheers. Risks and disclaimers. Bankless Nation, gotta let you know. Crypto is risky. Bitcoin
models are risky.
ETF, yeah, so are models. So is analysis. So is buying things and selling things as well. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's absolutely not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.